Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Patrick Donnelly. He's Nevada State Director at the Center for Biological Diversity and lives in the Mojave Desert on the edge of Death Valley. He's been involved in desert conservation for 17 years, including leading desert tortoise habitat and wetlands restoration projects, engaging local communities to achieve permanent protection for over 2 million acres of public lands in the California desert, and now advocating for Nevada's biodiversity and climate statewide. His work takes him from Las Vegas to Reno to Elko. I lived in Carlin for a couple of years, by the way, and all points between, whether lobbying in a suit or tromping through a desert marsh in muck boots. So first off, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Derek.
So today we're going to talk about a very specific project. Can you talk a little bit about the Rhyolite Ridge Lithium Mine Project? And what's wrong with it and what it is?
Yeah, well, folks are probably aware that lithium is emerging as an important strategic mineral as a part of the renewable energy revolution. It is used in the production of batteries, and it's thought that if we generate most of our energy from intermittent sources like wind and solar, we're going to need a tremendous amount of storage capacity. And thus there is a worldwide rush on lithium. North America currently has one producing lithium mine, in Clayton Valley, Nevada. And this, area, Rhyolite Ridge, is nearby. Rhyolite Ridge is unique because, the traditional method of producing lithium is to pump groundwater that contains lithium out of the ground and evaporate it out, generating a lithium salt from the byproducts, whereas Rhyolite Ridge is a clay deposit. It's a lithium-rich clay deposit. And so in order to access that lithium, they need an open-pit strip mine. So Rhyolite Ridge is in the Silver Peak Range of western Nevada, not far from the California border, about halfway between Las Vegas and Reno, 4 hours in either direction to get there. It's extremely remote. And the proposal is to put an enormous open pit strip mine there to mine the clays. The clays are also rich in boron. Boron and lithium are common associates. And then they use a sulfuric acid process to extract the lithium and boron from the ore, and obviously create quite a mess with what's left over. And notably for my organization and for others who are interested in Rhyolite Ridge, there is a very rare species that lives there, Teams buckwheat, it's called, Eriognum teamii, an endemic species that lives nowhere else on Earth except, right there at Rhyolite Ridge. And, this buckwheat, it's a little wildflower, it's about 3 inches tall. It's got white, creamy wildflowers in the spring, and it lives on just 21 acres of land, so just a handful of football fields in size of the habitat. There's an estimated to be about 20,000 buckwheats total in the whole world, and they are adapted to boron lithium-rich clays. So the very soils that the mining company wants to mine up and burn away with sulfuric acid to extract lithium and boron, those very same soils are what this plant is endemic to and adapted to and lives exclusively on. And so the bottom line is, if they build this mine, they will wipe out Teams buckwheat, drive it to extinction. So that has really raised concerns from my organization and many other people who care about native plant diversity.
So you said that they're about 20, I think you said they're on about 20 acres, 21 acres?
Yes.
And how big is the entire mine supposed to be?
It would be several thousand acres. We are in the preliminary phases still, so there's not a plan of operations for the actual mine itself. We are in still an exploration phase out there. So we know it'll be several thousand acres. We just don't know which several thousand acres. But as I said, the entire global population of Teams buckwheat lies within the ore body that they've located So no matter what the exact configuration is, it will include those 21 acres in the mine's footprint.
And I mean, those who know my work know that, that any species is important and vital in its own and deserves to live for itself. And having said that, can you talk a little bit more in addition about the entire natural community there? I don't have a picture of it yet. I lived in Nevada, like I said, in Carlin. And so I know some parts of Nevada, but is this sort of a rabbit brush scrub area? Is it, more like the Joshua Tree area? Is it a little, oasis? I can't picture the area. Can you tell me more about the larger area and the larger natural community?
Yeah, so the Silver Peak Range in western Nevada is the southern edge of the Great Basin Desert. And so there's a kind of a line about a third of the way up from southern Nevada where the Great Basin and Mojave Deserts meet. And you get a pretty interesting ecotone there. So, for instance, the valley, the southern end of the Silver Peak Range would have some Joshua trees in it at the very northern extent of their range, whereas further north in the Rhyolite Ridge area, you're getting into sagebrush. So you're in more characteristic Great Basin vegetation. It's also characterized by being hyper arid. So, I mean, the whole desert's arid, but this area is especially arid because immediately to the west is the White Mountains in California, which is a 14,000 foot mountain range. And then immediately west of that is the Sierra Nevada. And so the rain shadow is extremely pronounced. The Silver Peak Range gets, you know, 6 inches of rain a year, some precipitation a year. So hyper arid, low scrub, there's some sagebrush, there's some shad scale, there's some rabbit brush, but it's pretty, sparse vegetative community there in the Silver Peak Range. And, you know, that's why a plant like Team's buckwheat was able to carve out a little niche, in the environment there because, you know, as Ed Abbey liked to say, there's room there for life to breathe because things are pretty sparse vegetatively. You know, there's certainly a rich ecology there. I encountered a herd of 25 bighorn sheep at Rhyolite Ridge a couple months ago. There's mule deer there because there's a pinyon and juniper up higher on the mountain range, so we'll get some mule deer coming through that area. Certainly your typical desert assortment of badgers and lizards and rattlesnakes and small mammals. And, you know, small mammals are important in the team's buckwheat story. Buckwheats are prolific seed producers. And so they produce just hundreds of thousands of seeds per plant. And that provides ample food for the small mammal populations that live around there. So, you know, and furthermore, while the buckwheat lives on 21 acres, it provides an important role on those 21 acres. And we don't necessarily know what role those 21 acres play in the broader ecology of the whole Silver Peak Range. You know, there's just a fundamental principle of biodiversity is that everything's connected. And so Team's buckwheat likely plays a role that we can't even fathom in the ecology of that part of the desert. And thus, you know, whether it's just 21 acres, whether it's just some little seeds that are produced to feed some small mammals, you know, Team's buckwheat plays an important role in the ecology of the area that we can't even really necessarily begin to understand or characterize. And, you know, that's why we're fighting so hard to save this little plant.
And who are the small mammals who live there?
There would be pocket gophers. There would be, ground squirrels. We might have kangaroo rats, although it's a little cold there for kangaroo rats. So yeah, pocket gophers and also wood rats. Definitely wood rats there too.
And so, okay, now, so tell me a bit more about the mine itself. Who owns the mine? Who is pushing it primarily?
Yeah, so the mine is proposed by a company based in Australia called Ioneer. Ioneer is a pretty speculative endeavor They're traded on an Australian stock exchange at 11 cents per share. It's largely the brainchild of just a couple of investors. This guy named Bernard Rowe is the guiding light of Ioneer. And this mine proposal is to, you know, completely industrialize this area and produce thousands of pounds of lithium a year. They claim it's one of the biggest lithium deposits in the known world. I think we hear a lot of boosterism like that from mining projects of this sort. And, you know, this is definitely a speculative endeavor. I mean, we are treating it as if it is an existential threat to this species, and we think it is. But, you know, this mine isn't going to be built tomorrow. They only have a couple $1 million in total capitalization for the company. They would need hundreds of millions of equity and credit to build this mine. So they're still very much in the kind of hyping it on the markets and trying to attract investors and playing the kind of shyster game you play on the markets, the mineral trading markets, to build the hype about their project. And so it's a little bit fly by night, truthfully.
I've always thought that is really the time. I mean, if you have the energy to do it, that's really the time to try to stop these projects anyway. Early on rather than later after they've sunk in, after they're already heavily capitalized, it seems to me it's much harder.
Absolutely. I mean, they haven't even started the environmental review process for this mine yet. And, you know, we are trying to present an overwhelming suite of opposition. So we are, and we can talk about this in a bit, you know, engaging on numerous different administrative fronts to try to stop this mine. And hopefully, you know, we send such a clear message that you're not going to get this built easily that it falls apart. Because, you know, so much of the time for these mining companies that are kind of as much speculative instruments as they are actual mineral production outfits, the big thing is generating revenue per share for shareholders. And so that means quick and expedient production. That means quick and expedient moving to profits and profitability. And so if they think, oh, we're going to have a multi-year fight on our hands and litigation and, you know, all these environmentalists being a pain in our ass, they may just choose to move on sooner rather than later, because the prospects of quick and easy money start to fade. So that's why, you know, we have pushed as hard as possible on this thing from the minute we started engaging to try to convey just how serious we think this is. You know, sometimes with a mine, you're playing a game where you're trying to limit the impacts. You're trying to say, oh, maybe we can get some better mitigation out of this or whatever. But on this instance, like, you can't build this mine. If you build the mine, you wipe out the plant. And so there's no wiggle room. There's no compromise.
So I'm going to say something, and you can either go with it or not. It doesn't matter. I mean, whatever you want to do is great. That it has always struck me, even when I was young and not particularly politicized, it always struck me as just an extraordinarily bad idea that someone in Australia can harm land across the planet, just like somebody in Nevada should not be able to harm land in Australia. It's extraordinary to me. You know, when I lived in Carlin, you know, a lot of the mines that were destroying a lot of the nearby area were owned by Canadians. It's always struck me. Well, I'm going to tell one more story real quick, which is when I taught at Eastern Washington University, I had one student who was very right wing, and he used to own a timber mill, and he and I would be at sort of loggerheads over, and we disagreed completely on logging. And one thing we could agree on, though, is nobody should be allowed to clear cut further than, I don't know, a half mile from their house. And I mean, it's really blithe that all these people will destroy places where they don't live. That's all. I just wanted to throw that in there, and you can respond to it or not.
Yeah, I guess I'm not that concerned about who's doing the environmental destruction. You know, right now, the vast majority of the world's lithium comes from Bolivia and Argentina and Chile. And we are depleting aquifers in Bolivia right now so that we can be using our cell phones. And that's in some cases American companies traipsing down to Chile and using them like a resource extraction colony. So I mean, I agree that the global trade systems produce environmental degradation, but I'm not as concerned what the country of origin of the resource pillagers is.
Well, that's a good point. That's a fabulous point. So is this land? Let's talk a little bit more about the land. Is this BLM land? Is this who actually owns this land?
Yeah, this is Bureau of Land Management managed public lands. There's no special protective designation for the habitat there. They have declared Teams buckwheat to be a BLM sensitive species, but anyone who's ever engaged administratively on BLM environmental review processes knows that the BLM sensitive species designation is next to meaningless. And so that's why we petitioned to protect this plant under the Endangered Species Act, because this situation is tailor-made for the ESA, the Endangered Species Act. I mean, this situation is why the ESA exists, is to protect a species facing annihilation like this. So we submitted a petition to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to protect Teams buckwheat last October.
And in my experience, those processes take forever. How is that going?
It's going to take forever. We don't even have a 90-day finding yet, which is supposed to come 90 days after the petition is submitted. So that would have been 3.5 months ago when we got to that 90 days. Things are delayed. You know, we're going to be ready with our attorneys in October of 2020 to start litigating the second we're eligible. You have to wait a year after filing a petition before litigating. So we'll be immediately ready to pounce on that. You know, recognizing that Fish and Wildlife Service takes forever to do their business and frequently does the wrong thing anyway, we decided to engage the state of Nevada and their rare plant protection process. For some reason, no one seems to know why, the state of Nevada has a very robust native plant protection law. And no one had ever petitioned the state to protect a plant before. But I actually just was thumbing through the Nevada revised statutes and found a provision that allowed for petitions for native flora. And so we submitted the first ever petition to protect a plant under the Nevada Endangered Plant Law. And they are currently evaluating that petition as well. Now, obviously, it's been a little while, but I think coronavirus pretty much threw a monkey wrench into some of those processes. But we have two parallel protection processes going, just trying to hit this from as many angles as possible and to hit that expeditiousness. Because, Fish and Wildlife Service could take 10 years to protect the species, by which point it's obviously too late. So we're hoping the state moves more expeditiously. And in either case, you know, we have our attorneys at the ready to begin intervening as soon as it becomes clear that administrative agencies are dragging their feet on protecting this plant.
Well, I'm sorry if this is a really ignorant question, but how does that work with state protection on federal land?
You know, that's always an open question. With wildlife, the old management saying is that the feds own the habitat and the state owns the wildlife. That's obviously a gross oversimplification, but that's kind of the inherited management regime, if not the specific legal management regime. And so, it's a gray area for sure, which is why there's no substitute for the Endangered Species Act. You know, state protections might be a good interim protection, but ultimately, you know, the Endangered Species Act, the Federal Endangered Species Act, is the most powerful biodiversity conservation law in the world. And there's a reason that 99% of listed species don't go extinct. And that's because this law works. And so we are focusing every effort on achieving Endangered Species Act protections for Teams buckwheat.
You know, we've I've done a whole lot of interviews where people have talked about using the Endangered Species Act, but I don't think anybody has ever, I think we've always just sort of assumed that people know what it is. Can you give like a 2 or 3 or 4 minute primer on exactly what the Endangered Species Act is, what the point is, and how it is, supposed to be used, but just everything people need to know in 5 minutes about the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah, the Endangered Species Act is one of the most landmark conservation laws in history, and certainly, as I said, the most powerful biodiversity conservation law in the world. The Endangered Species Act makes it the policy of the United States that we don't let its species go extinct. That is our policy, that we fight extinction. And so that means, perhaps most importantly, all federal agencies, before conducting an action, have to consult, it's called consultation, with Fish and Wildlife Service to ensure that their action does not jeopardize the continued existence of an endangered species. That sounds very bureaucratic, but it basically means that before the government does anything, they need to make sure that they're not going to jeopardize an endangered species. And since the federal government has such interweaved finances with state and local agencies, in the end, most government authorizations have to go through Endangered Species Act compliance. So that means that most anything, from a building permit to a logging project to a mine to wastewater discharge to energy production, to damn near everything we do as a society, at some point has an Endangered Species Act screening on it. And that's critically important, because it's our actions that are bringing species to the brink of extinction, and it's only through our actions that we can save them. And so, you know, as a result of the powerful protections of this act, as I said earlier, 99% of species that get listed on the act are saved from extinction. That's an incredible success rate. You know, if the policy is prevent extinction, the act has been tremendously successful. Now, the act has had a shakier implementation record as far as recovering species. Recovering species is actually relatively rare. But preventing extinction, there is no better way to prevent extinction than the Endangered Species Act. And so, you know, that's why there's organizations like mine that exist historically primarily to engage and implement the Endangered Species Act. And there are other organizations who do the same. That's also why a tremendous amount of political effort is expended to protect the Endangered Species Act, which congressional Republicans have attacked over and over and over again for decades.
You said the word recovery, and for listeners, is recovery a required part? Does the ESA just supposed to protect them, or is the ESA legally supposed to help them recover?
The ESA does mandate actions toward recovery. However, it doesn't mandate recovery the same way it mandates preventing extinction. You know, we can sue Fish and Wildlife Service into the Stone Age if they try to do actions or authorize actions that would advance the extinction of a species. We can't do that if they are failing to recover the species. So they have to take certain actions, like develop a recovery plan, for instance, to recover a species. But the actual recovery of a species is non-enforceable. And, you know, there's reasons for that, in as much as so many exogenous factors to what's under Fish and Wildlife's control exist, that it would be pretty difficult to sue Fish and Wildlife every time a species didn't recover, given how little control they have over segments of actions that endanger species.
Was it the dusky seaside sparrow that that they were attempting to do a captive breeding program, and a hurricane destroyed the facility? I believe that was that, or it could be a different species. The point is that it was just an example of, I mean, they were actually trying, somebody was trying to do the right thing with whatever species it was, and a hurricane destroyed the facility, and there's nothing they can do about that. That's just,
I mean, once a species gets down to critically low levels, you're basically rolling the dice every day that they're not going to go extinct. Stochastic factors can always impact a species, particularly when they're at extremely low numbers and low distribution, because then a single catastrophic event can wipe out the species. You know, species are designed to be resilient. There's supposed to be many populations that then are resistant to stochastic events. So, you know, certainly there are examples of mishaps in recovery programs. I think by and large, recovery programs have been tremendous successes. And so, but nothing's perfect. You know, I was involved in a recovery program for an endangered species where they were supposed to reintroduce captive bred, animals, and half of them died before they could even be introduced, in the back of a minivan. They all died, during transport to the field site. So, you know, shit happens basically. But I think by and large, recovery programs have been oriented in the correct way.
So I'm going to ask you more about the, Fish and Wildlife and the Endangered Species Act in a moment, but the stochastic events made me think of another question about the buckwheat, which is in a dry place, what's the relationship, if any, between buckwheat and fire? Between that buckwheat and fire?
Fire would not have been a significant factor in this particular ecosystem. The species are too spread out, the individual plants, and so fire wouldn't have carried. I mean, maybe a single plant gets hit by lightning and it burns a couple plants around it, but it would never, there wouldn't be landscape scale fire in this ecosystem prior to disturbance. Now, you know, there are. There's invasives, there's cheatgrass, there's halogeton, which is growing there. And so there is a risk of fire in that ecosystem, but we haven't seen it yet. You know, I would say it's not on the highest level of threats to this particular species.
Okay. So back to the Endangered Species Act. So it's pretty, I mean, you've laid out really well how it works, and can you now help people understand why the process can be so slow? And you can be as forgiving as you want of the Fish and Wildlife. You can also be cynical. It doesn't matter to me either way. Just why does it take so long and once the process starts, why does it take so long?
Well, politics is the primary answer. I think a subsidiary answer is funding. The Republicans in Congress don't like the Endangered Species Act. They don't necessarily like Fish and Wildlife Service because they don't think the federal government ought to be managing wildlife. And so they throttle Fish and Wildlife Service's funding, and in particular, they throttle the listing budget. You know, the listing budget is just a few million dollars. It's very low. And so Fish and Wildlife is simply unable to meet the demands put on it by the Endangered Species Act because they're not funded adequately. So that's part of it, and the other part's politics. You know, for every environmental group like mine petitioning to protect a species, they've got a mining company like Ioneer whispering in their ear saying, don't do this. And Ioneer's got buddies. You know, I happen to be sitting on the plane next to Mark Amaday, the second district congressman from Nevada, a few months ago before the COVID crisis, obviously. And, you know, Amaday had been out there. He'd seen Team's buckwheat. I mean, our sitting congressman from the second district is intimately involved in this issue and is going out there to see the buckwheat. And he's a hardcore mining Republican. He was actually the president of the Nevada Mining Association before going to Congress. So, you know, you can better believe that Mark Amaday is out there working every single political angle he has to try to stymie Fish and Wildlife Service from protecting this species. And that's just one example. I mean, there's a whole political industrial complex supporting the mining industry in the state of Nevada, which is functionally a banana republic for the mining industry. You know, and so all those political forces are being brought to bear on Fish and Wildlife Service. And, you know, they can't, ultimately everyone's worried for their job, right? And so the guy whose concern is writing listing petitions for plants, writing listing decisions for plants, you know, maybe he thinks it ought to be listed, but then his boss is worried about their job. and their boss is worried about their job, and they, and then you move up the chain, and they're ultimately reporting to Aurelia Skipwith, who's the director of Fish and Wildlife Service and a former Monsanto lobbyist. And so, you know, and she reports to David Bernhardt, the oil lobbyist, who reports to Trump, who's practically Satan. And so, you know, ultimately, on down the line, everyone thinks if I step out of line, if I piss off my superiors, I might lose my job. And I got a mortgage and, you know, I can't lose my job. And so, ultimately, you get very politicized decisions coming out of Fish and Wildlife Service.
Okay, so I, and thank you for all that. And, you know, I've worked with a lot of issues around listing, and a lot of times they have arguments like, oh, there are other threats that are more severe, or oh, there are other parts of their habitat. What argument can they make in this case, since this is the, like you said, this is like the poster child for the ESA. So what arguments can the other side make that are not just naked force?
Yeah, Eye in the Ear has engaged in a concerted effort to greenwash their mine. They have hired the University of Nevada, Reno, to do a captive breeding program for Team's buckwheat, where they're, you know, they're growing them from seed in a greenhouse. And then the idea is they're going to go transplant these seedlings elsewhere in places not currently occupied by Team's buckwheat to try to establish other populations so they can destroy the native populations. This is A, completely ludicrous on its face and has never been successfully done. And most botanists think it's totally irresponsible. And B, it's a convenient piece of greenwashing. You know, they had a press release that came out a couple weeks ago, and it turned into an AP story that ran in 200 newspapers across the country about Australian mining company awards contract to University of Nevada to study rare wildflower. That was the story, as if, you know, they're just benevolent and really fanatic about wildflowers and handing out hundreds of thousands of dollars to study wildflowers for no good reason. No, they're threatening to drive a wildflower to extinction, and so they're basically bribing some scientists to come up with some convoluted, contrived way to, and this is a separate issue, but ultimately, if you're destroying a native species habitat and creating new habitat somewhere else, you are reducing that species to a set of genetic code. To us, a species is entirely intertwined with the habitat it lives in. They are one and the same. A species is a product of its habitat. It shapes its habitat, and it is a product of its habitat. And so if you wipe out a species' native habitat and then establish it somewhere else and say, oh, we're good here, we've saved the species, you're essentially saying that a species is nothing more than some DNA that you can toss around as if the place it's actually located is meaningless. And, you know, we feel like this is an extremely dangerous route to go down. And if this was the result, it would be a horribly problematic precedent to set, because, you know, that's not how ecology works. That species is meant to be in a certain place for a reason. And, you know, I think we look at the Endangered Species Act, and, I think that idea that you can just establish it somewhere else and then you don't need to protect the native habitat is clearly refuted by the ESA. Section 2B of the Endangered Species Act establishes the purpose of the act, and it says, the purpose of this act are to provide a means whereby the ecosystems upon which endangered species depend may be conserved. So that doesn't say to provide a means whereby the genetic material of endangered species may be conserved. It says the ecosystems upon which endangered species depend may be conserved. And so the ESA, in the text of the act, very specifically says the habitat is the species. Protecting the habitat is protecting the species. And thus, I think would never, you know, if Fish and Wildlife Service tries denying listing because they've established new populations elsewhere, we would fight that to the hilt And I think would very easily win that because it just so clearly violates the word and intent of the Endangered Species Act.
So I think that what you just said is one of the most important things that anybody has ever said on any of the interviews I've done. The whole about a species is not simply DNA. And I know you said it very clearly, but it's so important. Can you say that again? I just want people to really hear it, and I want them to get it.
Yeah, the analogy I like to use is, and I'm actually not a drinker, but the terroir of wine. You know, it's a term that refers to how wine takes on characteristics of the landscape it comes from, whether that's, you know, the flavors, whether that's whatever properties of wine, and it's intrinsically derived from the ecosystems, the weather patterns, etc., where that wine comes from. And so I like to think of species as the terroir of the lands that they reside on, the terroir of their habitat, where a habitat is a collection of abiotic factors like climate, like weather, like soil type, like landform and topography. And then it's also a collection of biotic factors like the plant community, the animal community, the fungal community, the bacterial and microbiome that provides the foundation of an ecosystem. And so all those elements combine to create what a species is. We only even can conceive of a species as relational to its habitat. And so the idea that you could just pluck a set of genetic material that we call a species out of its native habitat, stick it somewhere else and say you've saved the species is just, it's totally wrong. It would be like if we took you and put you on Mars and destroyed the Earth and said, oh, he'll be fine. You know, no, that's not the case. You can't just transplant people on Mars, and we may never be able to put people on Mars because it's not Earth where we came from. And so I think a species is so indelibly tied to its habitat that they are really one and the same thing. And to destroy a habitat is to destroy the species.
Thank you so much for that. And you mentioned bacteria, and I'm just going to throw this out, not knowing anything about that specific place myself. I know that some desert areas have a soil crust that develops over a long period of time, and they can be pretty fragile. Is this an area that has one of those soil crusts? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. The Southern Great Basin supports a robust community of biological soil crusts, and certainly the Silver Peak Range has those as well.
And can you tell listeners for like 2 minutes what they are?
Yeah, biological soil crust is a symbiotic community of bacteria, lichen, algae, and fungi, and they all live and work together in these little symbiotic communities that ultimately are what holds together desert soils. And so really most desert ecosystems across the West have biological soil crusts. And without biological soil crusts, desert soils just blow away in the wind. These biological soil crusts provide microtopography to hold water and moisture such that plants frequently have their seeds germinate within the topography of a biological soil crust. So they provide really a important locus for the ecosystem to develop.
Yeah, so again, this buckwheat is precious on its own, but all of that obviously goes if you have an open pit mine.
And it's not even just the open pit mine, you know. We fought a large fight over the autumn and early winter about exploration activities. You know, in the words of Arnold Thiem, the guy who identified this flower back in the 80s, one guy on a bulldozer could wipe out this species in an afternoon. Literally. One guy on a bulldozer could just wipe them out. And so we went out there last October and found really significant impacts happening just from exploration activities, and that's what ultimately kicked our asses into gear on the petition. And we ended up suing over those exploration activities. We settled out of court, but the net result was they halted the exploration after our litigation because, we found overwhelming proof that these activities were really negatively impacting teams' buckwheat. But the point is, the lithium mine is a huge threat, existential threat to the species. But this species already, because it's such a narrow endemic, you know, faces dire threats just even from exploration activities. Or, I saw some OHV off-highway vehicle tracks going off into the buckwheat habitat and trampling buckwheat. So there's a variety of factors threatening this species that we need to address.
Well, this is really important, too. This is one reason why we're so excited about the soil is that I grew up in Colorado, and go way up into the high country, you can see wagon tracks from 100 years ago on the alpine tundra. And it's the same. I saw that in Nevada, that there are some places, this soil crust, just driving an ORV or driving a truck across it can, these soil crusts can take a long time to recover.
If ever, on a human time scale.
Yeah.
You know, the buckwheat exploration impacts we were concerned about involved, you know, heavy equipment driving between buckwheat populations, potentially severing pollinator connectivity. And, you know, you're talking about a 20-foot wide swath of land that's been bulldozed in a place that gets 6 inches of rain a year with plants spaced out 3 feet between each plant. The idea that that's going to be recolonized on a human timescale is just a farce. I mean, that'll still be there 500 years from now. The actions we're taking right now on sensitive habitats in the desert are functionally permanent.
I think that's incredibly important for people to realize. So we have about 5 minutes left. I have a couple questions. One of them is, what's the nearest, you said this is pretty remote, 4 hours from Las Vegas, 4 hours from Reno. What's the nearest, human town? And
it's a very tiny town called Dyer, which is really just like a gas station and a community center in the middle of a valley with several farms. The closest like town is Tonopah, Nevada, which is about an hour and a half away.
And is this primarily, are the people who already live there, are they primarily, you said farmers, what do they farm and are there a lot of, is it also ranching?
There's definitely ranching, although it's dry country, so there's not a ton of cows out there. The people in Fish Lake Valley there farming are all raising alfalfa for the most part.
Okay, so we just have a couple minutes left, and if people, listening to this, how can they help the, Center for Biological Diversity, and how specifically can they help stop this particular, travesty?
Yeah, well, I would encourage everyone to go to biologicaldiversity.org and sign up for our mailing list. We're going to be doing action alerts. We do action alerts on all sorts of issues all the time. But in the next couple of months, we are hoping the state of Nevada begins to take action on the petition we submitted to them. And there's going to be a public comment period where we're going to need people who love wildflowers and oppose strip mines to write letters to the state of Nevada demanding protection for teams buckwheat. And so sign up for our mailing list. You can get more information about that as it comes available. And we're going to need folks to write letters and tell officials why it's important to protect biodiversity.
Thank you. Is there anything else you want to say about either this issue or this particular delightful little plant?
You know, I just think teams buckwheat is important to its little ecosystem where it lives. It may seem very remote to most people. But, you know, biodiversity is an incredibly complex web of species and habitats interacting across the globe. We don't know the value and effect of any individual component of the biotic community. And so, you know, every little narrow endemic species we lose has compounding effects. And all of a sudden we look around the globe and we have an ecology badly out of whack. And we're in the middle of a precipitous extinction crisis, which threatens our own lives on this planet. So I think saving Team's buckwheat is important because it's a pretty wildflower and an important piece of the Great Basin Desert. But stopping the extinction crisis, you know, it's our asses on the line. And so we need to stop the extinction crisis. And, you know, for us, we've drawn a line in the sand around Team's buckwheat, and we said not here.
Well, thank you for your advocacy for Team's buckwheat and other wildlife. And thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Patrick Donnelly. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.